Okay, this is interviewed with Bernard Tessman and also Carl Heimburg by Michael Neufeld, January 23rd, 1990, tape 2, side 1. Now I have to try to reconstruct just a little bit what's the only the really important parts of what we just missed when the tape stopped. So you were saying that on the working level, the relations with the Luftwaffe were pretty good.
It was very good, yes.
Mm-hmm. But and that some of the people who lived in, but you had some Luftwaffe people who lived in the bachelor quarters. In so that you remember, or was it Mr. Heimburger? Remember that you had some Luftwaffe people living in the bachelor quarters.
That's what Mr. Heimburger remembers. Yeah. We had in our living quarters some Luftwaffe or Reich West people living.
You didn't have much to do with them, huh?
I did not have anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't even really know what was going on over there?
No, I did not have any idea. I saw only airplanes going up and landing, but never knew exactly what was going on.
Mm-hmm. There was a fence between Werk Ost and Werk West, literally? Some kind on the grounds that divided the two, or
not that I remember.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? Was there a fence, Mr. Heimburg?
There was a fence between east and west. Yes.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, there was a fence.
And how could you go from one to the other if you wanted to walk there or take the bicycle? There was a couple of roads.
There were roads.
Mm-hmm.
I only want to mention the two from Werk West, Czerny and Kroger.
Oh, yeah.
Czerny, yeah, Czerny, I think I know who that
Kroger
is.
Mm-hmm. And both worked in West but lived in the bachelor quarter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because nearby there was the Fischer Kantine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they cooked the water soup and...
Not only that, but you had an officers' club. And we had one eater who did first go to the Kantine Fischer for lunch, and then he went to the officers' club. That was Obert.
Mm-hmm.
He had a tremendous appetite.
Hermann Obert.
Hermann Obert.
Yeah. Did you hear that he just died?
Yeah. Yes, he passed away. Yeah.
Just at the end of December.
95 years old.
Yeah, 95 years old.
We had seen him a couple of years ago here in Huntsville. He came to the Rocket and Space Center.
Space Museum.
Mm-hmm. Did you see much of him at that time at Peenemünde when he was there? He was only there for 2 or 3 years in the middle of the war, I guess. Hermann Obert, did you know him at that time?
Not while during his Peenemünde time. You may have known him. I believe I told you that when we had this explosion in Vorwerk Süd, I got the task to notify Obert, take him along to the funeral of his daughter.
Yeah, I remember you telling that anecdote in your interview, where you took him down there. You had nothing to do then with the joint projects with the Air Force, past the construction phase, right? Like Wasserfall, that you had not much contact with?
No, with Wasserfall, I was involved in one of the test stands also, test stand number 6, the Wasserfall vehicle had entirely different propellants.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a specific test position built to run component tests, fueling tests, even that firing static tests. I don't remember, but mostly component testing. But nearby there was a launch site, it was a lunch table. I had to do something with also mm-hmm. in design some of our people.
That was the launch site for Wasserfall.
Wasserfall, yeah. It was not a big deal. It was an instrumentation out of a trailer, an old trailer, and just a simple structure table. But the vehicle was held down by explosion bolts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now when you wanted to give the start command, you know, you had to push the button and then all the explosion bolts would have to go. But one or two did not at this time. So the thrust developed and the whole down deal tilted over on the side, and that was the only test run I had seen.
Mm-hmm.
It was a darned accident. It should not have happened.
I've heard of another Wasserfall test where it took the launch table with it, attached to the rear end.
That's the very same, but it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
You could not take this heavy launch
table. It just tilted over.
It just tilted over, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there she was, flat on her
And it
belly.
Exploded, I assume.
No, there was no
didn't
explosion.
Didn't explode, huh?
No, there was a fire, yes, in the lower section,
mm-hmm.
close to the table, but there was no explosion.
Were there particular difficulties in handling nitric acid, which, you know, it's all by?
Only in so far that all the hardwares, you know, they had to have special special material, I mean specifically the gaskets. We had gaskets problems, there's no question about it. We had gaskets problem even on the liquid oxygen side. They got brittle, and now in the Wasserfall, you know, they got eaten up.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily harder to
no,
deal
but
with.
Otherwise people handled the material
mm-hmm.
like liquid hydrogen. Of course, they had long leather gloves and aprons, you know, in front, just as a precaution.
Yeah, I guess in that sense, because you had not only the cold problems, but also the problem of an explosion from liquid oxygen coming in contact with grease or so oils or things like
or
that.
Or combustibles, you know.
Yeah.
Even wood or any other old material laying around.
Mm-hmm. That it wasn't harder to deal with that than it was to deal with nitric acid. Just a different set of
problems.
Well,
I was never worked out in the field.
Yeah.
Except a little bit in Kummersdorf.
Mm-hmm.
Where I had the chance to make a layout and the final design of a rotary test position. You know, what we did, we wanted to find out how the engine for a fighter would work under speed, you know. Normally, we took our so-called potato schnapps as a coolant for the engine, so it went through the engine, and then it was put into an ejector and ejected into the combustion chamber.
Yeah, through the injector.
Now, if on one side we mounted the engine, in the middle we had a little steel house, you know, for operation and some instrumentation, and on the opposite side to balance out, to counter it, there were heavy bottles with nitrogen for pressurization. And so the whole deal went around this way, and the operator was Dr. Werner von Braun. He was sitting in the middle, and you know, the whole darn deal running around this way, and everyone was looking for a good heavy pine tree.
Was he sitting on the end of the arm? It was almost
no,
like
he
a
was
centrifuge.
Sitting in the middle.
As the operator.
He was the operator. He was sitting in the middle. He didn't feel any big movements.
He didn't rotate
engine,
device.
You know.
Mm-hmm. That was the engine.
Fliehkraft, how do you call this in English? Just to check the fliehkraft, how the fuel gets relocated out of his position, you know, just by accelerating it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if the engine is really the engine for an airplane, you know, it feels all kind of velocities suddenly.
Mm-hmm. This was the engine that was also used for the airplane tests?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And later in Peenemünde on our test in number 4, where Günther Haukohl, who was still around also, was our test engineer at this time.
Mm-hmm.
No, the idea was the following. Before the war, or before the German army was in France, the question was, our aircraft cannot go too far, not to Great Britain. And if we create an auxiliary
device,
then we can do that. And that was the idea to get a device to the aircraft, to help the aircraft to start so that you get a bigger range.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea before France was occupied.
Oh, this is probably the main idea. But when I was put on the job first, the idea was the following of the Heinkel people. You know, there were some guys from the company Heinkel in Kummersdorf. They worked with us. The idea was to put a fighter plane up very quick, take it out of its camouflaged wooded area and put it on a meadow and just take it up without building any special fields, concrete runways.
Mm-hmm. You mean, was it a vertical takeoff or a short take?
It was a very short takeoff. It was supposed to a very short takeoff. You roll just a little bit across the meadow and then take off. This was the idea.
Yeah.
I never have seen an actually test connected to an airplane. Never have seen it.
Because I think that what you two are talking about is two different things. You're talking, Mr. Heinberg, you're talking about the Starthilfe, I assume, where they went into, you probably remember that too, Mr. Tessman, where they had the units to lift bombers off the ground. That was a project.
Oh, this was Starthilfe.
Yeah, that came later. But there was also the
take off aid.
Yeah, there was also the test with the fighter aircraft, the Heinkel aircraft, right? HE-112, HE-176.
Oh, I don't know
little,
the nomenclature.
Those little in the first rocket test with aircraft, I think, were when they put those engines on those Heinkel fighters. This is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Because I know they flew those tests. They flew some tests out of Vec Vest, you know, 38, 39.
I guess that's what was H2O.
There was also, there was a Starthilfe with alcohol and liquid oxygen. They later also built
Starthilfe,
one. Yeah, they also built a Starthilfe with, but that was a Walter motor.
Yeah, right.
But then there were those engines that were used with the Heinkel fighters. I think they just tested them in the air.
Ever I recall, I think it was the same propellant as we tried to develop small engines.
Those are the first versions.
Potato schnapps and liquid oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Ethyl alcohol, right? Mm-hmm. Is the correct.
Mm-hmm. You remember those early dealings with the Heinkel people is like at Kummersdorf, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with the Starthilfe project at all?
No.
Because I just looking at documents, I see it's still going on as late as 1941 or so. That they're. It's probably about the time that they stopped. They had those units that dropped off the bombers. I guess that was the Starthilfe system they tried to work out. You know, they helped the bomber off and then they dropped them back to the ground.
If you want to know that, you have to talk to Haukohl.
Mm-hmm.
Because he worked on that. And he came, did he come from Heinkel?
Günther comes from Heinkel, yeah.
Günther Haukohl.
Günther Haukohl.
Mm-hmm. How is he in terms of his health and so forth?
He's in good shape.
Uh-huh. Is he interested in talking to people? Yeah. Not everybody here wants to talk to interviewers.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you a story here. When Rudolf left mm-hmm. the United States, he called Haukel
mm-hmm.
and told him, "I am leaving the United States. These and these are the reasons. If you want to know more details, you have to talk to Rees. I only call you because you are the next one to be contacted."
Mm-hmm.
And he was contacted, had a lawyer, and the lawyer told him, "Look, if you want to do that, then you have an accusation. If you have an accusation, that's what you send here first before he talks to you."
Mm-hmm.
Never heard of it again.
Mm-hmm.
That was years ago. Years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he had sent a letter maybe 2 years ago. He wanted to have a question answered by OSI.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 or 4 months ago, he got an answer on that letter.
Mm-hmm.
That they said, "There's something against you, we cannot answer your question."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, since you ask, I do not know if he wants to have his name used. This is the reason I tell you that story.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's why I ask. I know that some people don't want to talk. And if that's their wish, then
you
that's
see,
fine.
Günter Haukel,
if you want to talk to him, I can contact him.
Mm-hmm. Günter Haukel came together with his, at this time, his superior.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Mr. Walter Günzel.
Mm-hmm. G-U-N-Z-E-L.
G-U-N-G-U-E-N-T-Z-E-L, Günzel.
Mm-hmm.
And his helper, Mr. Schön.
Mm-hmm.
These three fellows I remember well, Günter Haukel,
mm-hmm.
Günzel mm-hmm. and Schön, yeah.
They went back to Heinkel days. They went back to Heinkel?
No, Günter stayed with our organization. He later was in Peenemünde, the test engineer, and our testing number 4,
mm-hmm.
where we continued with the
mm-hmm.
Starthilfe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that interests me because, you know, for one thing, I'm trying to understand what other projects there were besides A4. Sometimes you read about Peenemünde and A4 as if they were identical. And of course, there was, you know, Wasserfall, and there was Starthilfe, and there was a few other things, although they were all less important, clearly. So one, and also relations between the Luftwaffe and the Army interest me, you know. How the cooperation worked, and whether there was any conflict there. So, yeah, that's why I'm interested in things like Starthilfe, because I don't, you know, I want to see what these other projects are.
I never mm-hmm. had time to look around or to listen to political things. I had
mm-hmm.
schedules and schedules that came
yeah.
out of here, you know, and.
Mm-hmm.
And if I did not produce in time, I had all kind of
difficulties.
People in front of me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never feared Werner von Braun because he was a fellow, I tell you. That's only once in my lifetime to work with a man like him.
Mm-hmm.
He had tolerance. He knew something about tolerance, you know. When I complained once about too much work and not enough helper, he said, "Tess, I tell you something. You are not supposed to work. You are a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you let the people work?" And that was the first and last time I complained to him about
mm-hmm.
not having enough time or not enough people.
Mm-hmm. But was he being realistic, or was he being joke? Was he joking?
No,
he
mostly he was very honest, very mm-hmm. serious. And
mm-hmm. But how?
He could be very kind, but he could be tough too. I tell you
mm-hmm.
that.
When was he tough?
I give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I had a problem, and I had 3 solutions, which mm-hmm. I could take. And I was not clear in my own mind, take out this, or take out this solution. So I thought, that would be ideal to discuss it with von Braun. And von Braun listened to me and said, look, this is not my problem, this is your problem. I tell you afterwards if your judgment was right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He was a realist.
Mm-hmm. As far as your experience goes, was he ever tough with you,
no.
Von Braun?
I wouldn't know. I don't remember.
Never. You never really dealt with those problems at his level in general?
Hmm? Never.
Oh, yes. You did.
Well, of course, he came around and complained if something was not the way as he thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. But mm-hmm. It didn't happen too often, I'm proud to say.
Really. Yeah. How did he, how was his influence felt in terms of making the place run well? You know, it's kind of a vague question, but what way did von Braun's personality shape the atmosphere or influence the way people worked? You know, what was the influence of von Braun's
his personality? His tremendous knowledge and his way of to convince people and to discuss mm-hmm. the most complicated things in a very simple and understandable way.
Mm-hmm.
And this
that was the biggest advantage of von Braun. The most complicated thing he could explain in very, very simple terms.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to NASA headquarters more than one time, that NASA headquarters had a discussion with our lawmakers,
mm-hmm.
mainly on the monetary side. And when they explained something, they were interrupted. Why don't you send us von Braun?
Mm-hmm.
He can give us a better explanation than you.
Mm-hmm.
Which did not give him the best connection with NASA headquarters once in a while,
mm-hmm.
after they had gotten this information.
And he had a good sense of humor, too. I'll tell you one thing, it just comes to my mind. You know, we had scheduled a static test run on our test in number 7 one late afternoon. And so von Braun always wanted to be present, not always, but at this specific case. There was a special test set up with a so-called Federfesselung in order to apply some side forces to the vehicle, and then the guidance system was supposed to get it back in its original position, and he wanted to see how this Federfesselung deal worked, which was a pretty complicated calculation effort by some companies, of course. I couldn't do it myself or our people. It was done in Schweinfurt by a special company. Well, anyhow, he was late, and his secretary called. Mr. Fehrenberger was a test engineer in charge, and he was complaining, and he was nasty to the secretary. Well, anyhow, she said, well, wait another 20 minutes or so, then he will be through. He has a long distance call. So he had to replenish liquid oxygen because we lost quite some amount, and it was supposed to be a long duration run of 60 seconds. We called it long duration.
Mm-hmm. It seemed long at the time.
It was long for us. Well, he came, and in the meantime, we had gathered together with all kind of fellow workers and talked about all kind of things, but about the test run. And then suddenly von Braun showed up. You know, here he came and hit our crew. He came, he said, what's going on here? I thought you are working. So yeah, we've been waiting for you. You are late, and you caused us tremendous problems, you know. Again, we had to top off liquid oxygen. So, okay, nothing else. But anyhow, he reported from his trip to the Wolfschanze in Prussia, where he had shown a film and reported about the success of the V2 launch
mm-hmm.
to the Führer and other higher officers. And he said how it had came out and how people behaved and so on. And one of the fellows said, Dr. von Braun, I don't understand. How do you do it? You just go in front of the Führer and high officers and just talk so freely? How do you do it? Do you have a drink before, or what do you do? And Von Braun said, oh, no, no, if I have a drink, I wouldn't know what I'm talking about. So all you have to is you have to have enough imagination, he said. What do you mean by imagination? You just imagine all these guys in front of you in their standing in their underwears. And that's such a ridiculous picture here, he said, that you lose all your respect. I remember this so well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, of course, a famous visit in July 43. Oh, so yeah. He was, at that point, did he seem like he was very upbeat, mm-hmm. optimistic about the fact that he had received
he
approval?
He always was optimistic, yes. But later than it had shown, you know, that they cut our money and we didn't get enough material because the whole program was shifted over to the Air Force for Jaeger's fighter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had tremendous problems to get the right material in time.
But mm-hmm. that was at a different time. What you are talking about was long before that visit of Von Braun to Adolf.
Oh, it could be, yes, could be.
Well, there were also problems in 44. Two, when for a short time priority shifted from V2 to V1.
Yeah.
So it but could be in 44 as well.
But we were less connected at Peenemünde mm. at that time than the Mittelwerk.
Mm-hmm.
They were really in a bad shape at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, they lost priority for a short right. for a while.
For a while.
Yeah. But since you, and in fact both of you, were involved with test stands, you didn't have much to do with putting the A4 into production, right? Because that was such a huge job.
That's where Otto Rudolf was in.
Yeah.
Very much so.
But I get the impression that also very many people in Peenemünde themselves were having to spend most of their time working on contracts and subcontracts and drawings for new versions of the same part and so forth, right? The whole job of keeping the thing in production.
I could give you one example where we were involved with the production. You know, we had the test stand number 8 for combustion chambers only. Mm-hmm. Each combustion chamber had to be, you might say, be calibrated because the pressure losses were different in each engine since they were handmade
yeah.
at that time. And the following test stands were not ready yet. And they were waiting for combustion chambers for the Mittelwerk. And we had a problem on test stand number 8. And I called Von Braun and told him we have to stop it because we are destroying the test stand now. He said, don't stop it. Go as far as you can with tests until it's impossible. And we did that. Remember, we had mm-hmm. to destroy the concrete.
Oh, yeah, I remember too. Mm-hmm.
That was when Von Braun insisted you have to do it because we have to deliver the
mm-hmm.
the engines, the combustion chambers.
A question coming out of that is that there were, I've seen a number of drawings and photographs, supposedly 3 circular areas. There were new test stands that were being built up more towards the west side
Werk
of the
Süd.
Island.
We called it Werk Süd.
Mm-hmm.
This was Mr. Rudolph's new mm-hmm. area.
Mm-hmm.
And this was under planning and partly under construction. I also was involved in these 2 test positions.
Mm-hmm.
But one was only built, not even ready.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the instrumentation was missing.
Mm-hmm.
All other hardwares were around, and there Mr. Hermann Weidner was put in charge as a test engineer or test director in this area.
What was his last name?
Weidner, W-E-I-D-N-E-R, Weidner. Mm-hmm.
And that was those were test areas that were supposed to be part of Versuchsserienwehr.
Richtig, right, right.
And they were only one was half finished and then never used.
Well, by the bomb, this test facility was destroyed. And
correct.
After we had that accident at Vorwerk Süd, you know, where the complete engineering staff was killed, Weidner and his people were transferred to that test position to repair it and run the tests down there.
That was in Austria, right?
It was in Austria, yeah. Vöcklabruck, Vöcklamark.
Vöcklabruck, okay. Now, so that the plan was, I should direct my questions basically to him, but the plan was to test engines that were completed at the Rudolf, the Vexud, or in these test facilities.
In our new Vexud complex, yes. And there was not only two test positions I'm talking about, but he had his own headquarter building in Werksüd, a very huge hangar for overall assembly work and checkout work. There was a huge high hangar, you know, where you could put the complete vehicle into a superstructure vertically. And before you took it to the launch site, you built your gyro scope in and instrumentation panel in order to check out with a certain force you inserted the rudders which are supposed to keep the vehicle in its pitch and yaw position. And the rudders were exposed to the high temperature jet. And that worked like your rudder in your boat, you know. But the rudders had to be moved in some way. So they got the command from the gyro and checkout panel and through an electrical connection, a solenoid valve got operated and either opened or closed. So when the command open came, the solenoid valve let an oil pressure through to a actuator, you know, which then in turn turns the rudder. Either way, whatever. We did not have computers at this time. It was a simple electrical panel connection from the gyro. To Fritz Müller should give you the complete and correct
this explanation. This was a test that was going to be done on completed vehicles coming out.
Yes, before you send them out for launch.
Was that done at also at the older assembly, Zusammenbauwerkstatt?
No, it was across of this. There was also the same building. Practically, it was a carbon copy in Werksüd later.
But it was bigger, I gather, that the Werksüd.
It was a little bit larger because we had to reconsider, or we had to consider the future. You know, as Braun always used to say, a good city planner does not plan for 10 years, but he plans for 25 to 50 years in advance, and that's the same you have to do with your facility planning and design. That I remember so well. He told me before I started ever taking up my new job.
Now, that reminds me of something I hadn't thought about. In an article by Kraft Erika, it was mentioned that there was some long-range plan to have a city of 30,000 people and various facilities at Peenemünde to make this into a research facility. Do you know any? You didn't hear about any of this.
No.
I have never seen a reference that backs that up.
No, never.
That, you know, so when you were planning for Peenemünde back in 36, 37, so forth, you just were planning the facility more or less.
For the present needs.
Yeah, plus some facilities were big enough to take
to continue our works we had already going on in Kummersdorf, and then with the growth potential going into the A4 development.
You built facilities large enough to take the 100-ton thrust motor that was projected.
Our tester number one was actually the only one who could have taken it dimensionally as well as from the force side.
And the Zusammenbauwerkstatt, I gathered, as well, was built big enough.
High enough.
To take a
the crane
a vertical
lift would have been high enough, yes.
Vertically to for the projected size.
Yes.
Of an A10. Did those dimensions enter into the Versuchsserienwerk of Werksud? Did they make those big enough, or are they just big?
They must have.
Mm-hmm.
They must have. Otherwise, you cannot do a real good planning.
Mm-hmm. That's a question for Rudolf.
Planning means you have to know in advance, you know, how the future looks.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to work with the Advanced Projects Office to find out about dimensions, at least dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Details at this time of planning is not so important yet.
Mm-hmm. So that, but you know nothing about this. Other talk about a plan, a master plan for some big town connected to. To Peenemünde or anything like that. I've never seen any evidence to back it up. Just a reference. Okay, I guess we're getting towards the end. I'm trying to think if we've covered, you know, the war. We've covered anything that we've covered everything.
It could be that this was a discussion between Erika and von Braun, just a conversation.
Yeah.
About planning the future, what should we do? So this could have happened. But not more than a conversation. I never had that before.
Mm-hmm. No real plans, existed for that. Just maybe an idea.
I do not like so much in our discussion, Dr. Neufeld, we mention so often people's name, you know, and occasionally not in a very rosy way. So.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I do not like at all, if this is out in hiding.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can control who reads the transcript if you want. You can make conditions on who reads. But I think in fact, out of all the people we've talked about, there really is only one example that matters, and that's Walter Riedel, and, you know... And I don't think that is so,
you know,
so crucial because
his family is still alive and he has a wonderful boy, Hans Riedel.
Yeah.
He is a great guy. He.
Mm-hmm. It's only I think necessary to mention it in explaining what changes were made in terms of why he moved out and why Walter Riedel III moved in. That was about the only case where, you know, it's even necessary to mention it. That he didn't get along with everybody. I don't think it's necessary to do anything more with that factor, those anecdotes at all, you know. I respect the fact that you don't want to talk about people and then see the same story turn up in print.
Of course, it's our conversation, you know. We talk, you ask questions, and then you react. But often when I was in an interview and that later came out in writing, I said, "Man, in the heck, why didn't she or he send me a copy first?" So, you know, after the interview, so many things go through your mind and you say, "Boy, I forgot this, and this should have been mentioned," and so on.
Oh, that which reminds...
Specifically if you mention certain datas, you know, there you could be so wrong.
Yeah. No, I think I want to say a couple of things. Number one, you will get a transcript. And if you want to cut anything out, you have the right to cut it out, okay? So that means that, in fact, yours will come, Mr. Heinberg, yours will come in probably in a month or two when they finish it. But you have the right to say, I don't want this in the written copy. So that you, and you have the right to say that you don't want this given out to anybody, you know, in terms of who reads it.
No, don't get me wrong. I did not mention anything which is not right or true.
Yeah, no, I understand.
But I do hate the personal discussion.
You see, the thing is, from the standpoint of the historian, what's interesting about those things is just that in any human organization, you're going to have conflicts. Not everybody's going to get along with everybody else. And sometimes the conflicts help you to understand how things were organized and what, you know, what frictions there might be, because that's just normal, you know. There's nowhere do you have an organization where there's never an argument or never a disagreement, you know. And so that's not, you know, I don't think in most cases it's really a problem. But you will get a transcript of this if you want to read over and say anything about what shouldn't be in it. Now, we were near the end of the war, more or less, I guess. I mean, we covered almost everything.
And don't forget, in my case, it's not so easy to go through a stroke and then come up and remember or things which had happened so many, many years ago. In between, you had your life too, and certainly lots of problems also.
The thing about that is that
even working with that guy,
you had once in a while a difficulty, right?
Once in a while, I have to mention it, so you shouldn't forget about it.
As far as the accuracy thing is concerned, I understand that memories are not perfect. I mean, that's part of doing oral history, that you have to check what people say against documents, and then say, well, I think most often it's just a matter of dates particularly. It's hard to remember exactly when things happened, but you can often find out when it happened from documents.
Dr. Neufeld, I want to make one proposal for whenever it's out in printing. Why don't you try to get you a fine copy of complete Germany and show specifically the location of Peenemünde, and then of Peenemünde make an extra large area to show this in details how it's located.
Yeah, because I think it shows necessary.
So many details. People like to understand why exactly this area or that area.
I think
they destroyed, you know, the government controlled bird sanctuaries and so on.
Well, I think that definitely you need a map, and that's of course in Dr. Dornberger's book. There's a good map.
Oh, is that?
Probably need another map again, definitely, of Peenemünde and also of sites and elsewhere in Germany. But
I wish we would have a blackboard. I could make a complete picture about the location and how the Peenemünde, the Peene, developed and where.
I remember. I remember the maps that have been printed in various books. But
I see.
I would like to see something even more detailed, you know, that the buildings you were talking about in the central part of the thing. But I must be getting close to the point when you're getting tired of being interviewed something. Do you want to go on much longer?
Well, as long as you have a backup, as we have in this case, you know, it's
because I certainly don't want to go on too long or tire you out excessively.
I guess I quit for today.
Yeah, just one or two questions at the very end. And I know you were evacuated in February or March of 45 from Peenemünde down to central Germany. Is that
35?
No. 45, I mean.
45.
Yeah. You were evacuated when? Right at the end of
January or February?
It was in January 45, yes. Mm-hmm. So I had to go to Thüringer, to Artern.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I built up our design office, set up our design office again.
Mm-hmm. And there was there much to do there, or?
It was in the building of the Artern newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I got a very huge room to put up drawing boards and so many people, you know.
Mm-hmm. And did you have much to do there, or did you passing the time?
No, mm-hmm. That never was the case.
They kept trying to make you work anyway.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, we had to deliver, and I had to work with an officer's name was Schnackenburg in Berlin headquarters, and he was in charge of all the documentation for as-built documents, you know. And these things I had to gather together for the troop doings, the Meiler wagon, transport wagons, and Feuerleit Panzer, and all these instrumentation trucks.
So that's
all this had to be continued.
And
documentation, not so much research or new design work.
More of the handbooks and so forth.
Carry things together and put them together as documents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so then at the and I
it was not boring, I must say, because at this time we learned, everyone learned lots of things he had worked on once but forgot about things, and then it comes back again if you see your own work coming up again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, since I'm running out of tape and you want to stop, I think this would be a good place to stop for today. Thank you.